WRCT Pittsburgh. We love monkeys.
Hi, this is Felicia Collins from Late Show with David Letterman, and you are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
WRCT, the inside from way out.
Soul
is next.
We don't actually have the legal documentation to back that up.
This is Ian McCulloch, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Top Dog in Pittsburgh, WRCT.
This is Danny Glover, and you're listening to 88.3 FM WRCT Pittsburgh.
Hi, we're the 1985, and whenever we're in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, we like to pick up 13-year-old runaways at the Greyhound station and listen to WRCT!
Woo! Listening to WRCT Pittsburgh's Radio Automation. Please stay tuned for more incredible tracks from our extensive, vast, libidinous, and...
balls.
Awesome. I called it libidinous. That doesn't make any... I mean... It.
WRCT Pittsburgh. We love monkeys.
Hello, this is Adam Clayton here, the bass player from U2. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
WRCT Pittsburgh.
Yeah, that's where things like this go. Right down the drain.
Yo, there's only 6 degrees of separation and we know 5 people you know. How much longer did you really think you could avoid strict flow? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM. Like this!
WRCT is on AOL Instant Messenger. Our screen name is WRCT883. Send us a shout out so we can make fun of your atrocious spelling. Send us a request. Send us anything. We're bored. WRCT. 88.3 FM on your radio, WRCT.org on the internet, and now WRCT 883 on AOL Instant Messenger. In the language of the kids today, we're the bomb. That's right, isn't it? That's what the kids say. We're the bomb, correct?
Is Mark G of the Evolution Control Committee, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, where the drunken pants are going wild.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
RCT, the inside from way out.
This is Grant Lee Phillips telling you, if you're wondering where you're tuned to, it happens to be 88.3 FM, radio's finest, WRCT, Pittsburgh.
From New York, Rock Raider.
Yeah, yeah, 1-2, Total Eclipse.
From Executioners, and we chilling on WRCT.
Word up, Pittsburgh representing 88.3 FM.
Check it out,
down. Aight, peace.
You're tuned to WRCT Pittsburgh's automation.
Hi, this is Martin Atkins from Pigface, and you're listening to WRCT 88.3 FM.
WRCT is the best place to be. He sends the music out your way 40 hours every day.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The Norwegian Nobel Committee has decided to award the Nobel Peace Prize for 2021 to Maria Ressa and Dmitry Muratov for their efforts to safeguard freedom of expression.
The 2021 Nobel Peace Prize has been awarded to journalists in the Philippines and Russia. We'll hear Maria Ressa in her own words.
Press freedom is not just for journalists. I think this is a critical time for democracy around the world, both in the Philippines and in the United States. And you must fight for your rights while you still can.
Then the family of Henrietta Lacks is suing the pharmaceutical company Thermo Fisher Scientific for profiting from Henrietta's cells that were taken without her consent in 1951 and have been used for decades by scientists. We'll speak with civil rights attorney Ben Crump and Henrietta Lacks' grandson.
The Lacks family is here together today to let the world know we want our family legacy back.
Plus, we'll look at the life and legacy of civil rights icon Fannie Lou Hamer.
Is this America, the land of the free and the home of the brave, where we have to sleep with our telephones off of the hook because our lives be threatened daily, because we want to live as decent human beings in America?
We'll speak to historian Keisha Blaine, author of the new book, Until I Am Free, Fannie Lou Hamer's Enduring Message to America. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Pfizer and BioNTech have officially asked the Food and Drug Administration to authorize its coronavirus vaccine for children between the ages of 5 and 11. The FDA is expected to rule on the request by the end of the month, meaning some 28 million children may soon be able to get vaccinated. The number of children infected by COVID has soared in recent months with the spread of the Delta variant. According to the American Academy of Pediatrics, children accounted for about a quarter of all infections last month. In other pandemic news, a new study in the journal Pediatrics has found roughly 140,000 children lost a parent or caregiver during the first 16 months of the pandemic. The study found Black, Latinx, and Indigenous children were impacted the most. In international news, COVID deaths in Russia have topped 900 per day this week for the first time since the pandemic began. Venezuela says the International Monetary Fund's not delivered funds that are part of a global program to help countries combat the pandemic because of the ongoing refusal to recognize elected President Nicolas Maduro as the nation's head of state. Venezuela blamed the United States for imposing a veto on Venezuela at the international body. A new draft report from the Senate Judiciary Committee revealed Donald Trump directly asked the Justice Department 9 times for help to overturn the 2020 election. The report sheds new light on the role played by top DOJ official Jeffrey Clark, who Trump considered installing as attorney general in the final weeks of his presidency because he supported subverting the election. The report states, quote, Trump's efforts to use DOJ as a means to overturn the election results was part of his interrelated efforts to retain the presidency by any means necessary, unquote. Senate Judiciary Chair Dick Durbin spoke on Thursday.
This president, former President Donald Trump, would have shredded the Constitution to keep his office in the presidency.
In related news, Trump has directed former Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, former advisor Steve Bannon, and other 2 aides to ignore subpoenas issued by the House committee investigating the January 6th insurrection. On Thursday, the committee issued new subpoenas targeting the key planners of the so-called Stop the Steal rally. The Senate's approved a short-term deal to increase the debt ceiling to prevent the federal government from defaulting on its debt for the first time ever. The deal gives the federal government enough money to make debt payments until early December. Newly released body cam footage shows Minneapolis police officers talked about, quote, hunting protesters in the days after the police killing of George Floyd last year. In one video, an officer is heard saying, quote, "You guys are out hunting people now. It's just a nice change of tempo."
It's just a nice change of tempo.
Yep, agreed.
These people.
Be very, very quiet.
Let them have it, boys. Let them have it.
Get out of here.
Right there. Get him. Hit him.
In another video, officers are seen celebrating after firing rubber bullets at protesters.
Gotcha!
The videos came to light during the trial of Jaleel Stallings, a black man who was recently acquitted of charges of shooting at Minneapolis police officers during the George Floyd protests. Stallings told the jury he was acting in self-defense after men in an unmarked van started shooting at him and others. He learned later the gunmen were police officers firing plastic rounds. The 2021 Nobel Peace Prize has been awarded to journalists Maria Ressa and Dmitry Muratov for, quote, their courageous fight for freedom of expression in the Philippines and Russia. Maria Ressa is the co-founder of investigative outlet Rappler, which has become one of the Philippines' most widely read news sites, despite being the frequent target of attacks by the government of President Rodrigo Duterte. Dmitry Muratov is one of the founders and editor-in-chief of independent Russian newspaper Novaya Gazeta. Six of the newspaper's reporters have been killed since its creation, including Anna Politkovskaya in 2006, a fierce critic of Russian President Vladimir Putin and the Chechen War. The Wall Street Journal's revealed a small team of U.S. Special Operations Forces and Marines have been secretly operating in Taiwan for at least a year to help train Taiwanese military forces for a possible conflict with China. This comes as the CIA has set up a new mission center focused solely on China. On Thursday, CIA Director William Burns described China as, quote, the most important geopolitical threat facing the United States. Two school teachers in the disputed region of Kashmir were killed on Thursday by masked gunmen in what's believed to be the seventh deadly attack against civilians within the past week. A militant group known as the Resistance Front claimed responsibility for the killings. Police say suspected militants have killed 27 civilians in Kashmir this year, where tensions have been steadily growing. In 2019, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi tightened control of Kashmir, and groups have also accused the Modi government of repression and severe human rights abuses in the region. The family of Argentine journalist Sebastián Moro is demanding an investigation into his mysterious death, which took place in Bolivia during the U.S.-backed coup that overthrew President Evo Morales in November 2019. Moro was reportedly found semi-unconscious with signs of physical violence. His mother said, quote, "Sebastián was the first journalist in the world to announce and denounce the military coup, and at the same time, he was its first fatal victim." The UN Human Rights Council has voted to shut down a war crimes probe into the U.S.-backed Saudi war in Yemen. A number of European countries wanted the probe to continue for another 2 years, but Saudi Arabia lobbied heavily against the resolution. The Cairo Institute for Human Rights Studies said the vote marked, quote, "a blatant attempt by Saudi Arabia and its allies to ensure blanket impunity for themselves after having been linked to war crimes and other grave violations of international law in the country." Human Rights Watch's Jim Fisher had urged the council to back the war crimes probe.
Failing to renew the mandate when it is still urgently needed would be a stain on the credibility of this council and a slap in the face to victims. Rather than bowing to pressure by any party to the conflict, seeking to evade scrutiny for its own abuses, HRC members should stand with the people of Yemen by renewing the expert mandate at this critical time.
Back in the United States, immigrant justice advocates are denouncing the Biden administration over its plans to turn a private prison in Pennsylvania into a for-profit ICE jail. That's Immigration and Customs Enforcement. The facility would detain over 1,800 people and will be run by the GEO Group, one of the country's largest private prison corporations. A coalition of rights groups is calling on the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights to intervene on behalf of expelled asylum seekers and demand the Biden administration stop using Title 42, the Trump-era policy, which allows the U.S. to expel recently arrived migrants without due process. Texas, Attorney General Ken Paxton says he'll appeal a federal judge's ruling, which temporarily blocked the state's near-complete ban on abortions. The New York Times reports at least six clinics resumed performing abortions on Thursday, a day after the ruling. U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland has praised the judge's ruling, saying it was a, quote, victory for women in Texas and for the rule of law. A new investigation by Reuters has revealed AT&T, the world's largest communications company, has played a major role creating and funding the far-right One America News Network, or OAN. Court records show AT&T has provided tens of millions of dollars to the network in exchange for the right to air the TV station on AT&T-owned platforms. The founder of OAN, Robert Herring Sr., has even admitted AT&T urged him to launch the station because, quote, they wanted a conservative network. OAN's played a leading role amplifying Donald Trump's lies about the 2020 election. And the Biden administration's restoring federal protections for three national monuments that were drastically rolled back by Trump to allow for commercial exploitation and extraction. The monuments are Bear's Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante in Utah, and the Northeast Canyons and Seamounts off the coast of New England. Over 3.2 million acres will come back under federal protection in Utah alone. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin the show with a Nobel Peace Prize. This year's winners have just been announced.
The Norwegian Nobel Committee has decided to award the Nobel Peace Prize for 2021 to Maria Ressa and Dmitry Muratov for their efforts to safeguard freedom of expression, which is a precondition for democracy and lasting peace. Ms. Ressa and Mr. Muratov are receiving the Peace Prize for their courageous fight for freedom of expression in the Philippines and in Russia. At the same time, they are representatives of all journalists who stand up for this ideal in a world in which democracy and freedom of the press face increasingly adverse conditions.
Dmitry Muratov is the co-founder and editor of the Russian newspaper Novaya Gazeta. Six of the newspaper's reporters have been killed since its creation, including Anna Politkovska in 2006, a fierce critic of Russian President Vladimir Putin and the Chechen War. Maria Ressa is the founder, CEO, and executive editor of Rappler, an acclaimed news website in the Philippines. She's been repeatedly arrested by the Rodrigo Duterte government, which has threatened to shut down Rappler. She spoke earlier today on Rappler.com after she won the Nobel Prize.
We have all long said this since 2016, that we are fighting for facts. And when we live in a world where facts are debatable, when the world's largest distributor of news prioritizes the spread of lies laced with anger and hate and spreads it faster and further than facts, then journalism becomes activism. And that's the transformation that we've gone through in Rappler, that we were on quicksand trying to figure out, how do we do what we do? How can journalists continue the mission of journalism? Why is it so difficult to continue telling the community, telling the world what the facts are, right? So in a battle for facts, I guess what this just shows is that that the Nobel Peace Prize Committee realized that a world without facts means a world without truth and trust. And if you don't have any of those things, you certainly can't conquer coronavirus. You can't conquer climate change. I've been saying this over and over, and it feels a little bit like, you know, Sisyphus rolling the rock up the hill. And when you get attacked in the process of trying to roll the rock up the hill, you just kind of dodge. You keep going. And it's a shock. But the fact that a journalist from the Philippines and a journalist from Russia won the Nobel Peace Prize tells you about the state of the world today and the state of the Philippines.
Filipina journalist Maria Ressa responding to winning the Nobel Peace Prize today. In 2019, she came into Democracy Now! Studios here in New York and talked about the fight for press freedom in the Philippines.
So I was arrested twice in about 5 weeks and detained once. And, you know, I have to say, I think it's just to make sure that I feel the power of the state. It's something that the pace of all of this has been unprecedented. And I've covered the Philippines for more than 30 years. In 14 months, we've had 11 cases filed by the Philippine government. I've posted bail 8 times, and then it just keeps coming. We're going to face every single one in court, and I could face decades in jail if we lose them. And one of the things that always, it just hit me a few days ago that since January 2018, when we've really begun facing all of this, we have not won one single motion. Not one, regardless of how ridiculous the cases are.
Explain what he's charging with you. What's this foreign ownership issue, the tax issue?
So I think you have to look at the whole thing, and it's about 3 years long now. It's preceded by attacks on social media, astroturfing, right? It's fake. They seed it. It grows, and people think it's real. And the first attack is that was actually by pro-Duterte bloggers saying that random question by one of the ones who became a government official underneath. She headed social media for the presidential palace. Her first question was, is Rappler CIA? It begins there. And then what's seeded is that Rappler is foreign funded. The actual case is that we're controlled by foreigners. So ludicrous, precisely because even in the Philippines, we're known for our independence. The thing that's most alarming for me, though, is the fast pace of something called the cyber libel charge. In this one, a story we published 7 years ago, before the actual cyber libel law was enacted, is being used against us to say we violated the law that didn't exist yet. I don't know how else to... when I first saw it, I laughed. The National Bureau of Investigation, its own lawyers, threw it out, and yet a week later, it's resuscitated, and now it's in court.
I want to go to what happened when you were just released from jail, just this small clip.
You cannot harass and intimidate journalists to silence. We'll stand up and fight against it. And as long as we are a democracy under a constitution which has a Bill of Rights, we will demand our rights be respected.
So what happens to you when you are detained? And have you dealt directly with Duterte, the president of the Philippines?
I have. I mean, the last interview I did with him was December of 2016. And the interview that I did with him in October 2015 actually helped bring him to the attention, helped the critics of President Duterte point out that Rappler, because we covered him fairly, actually helped him get elected. Certainly, he knew the power of Rappler, our millennial demographic, and that's perhaps part of the reason that we're under attack. But I think there's something far more insidious that's happening now. It's normalizing these attacks. You know, when you say a million times that I'm a criminal, even though it's not true, people begin to believe. And that's what happened first on social media. The attacks became normal. And then people who had never met me then began to believe it. Then, a year and a half later, when President Duterte comes down and says, you know, Rappler is owned by foreigners, the cases began a week later, and we're sandwiched there. It's a tough place to push back, but I think it's truly important to do that because this is the time... I think this is a pivotal moment for Philippine democracy. This is the time when we have to fight for the rights that are guaranteed by the Constitution.
So you have Duterte saying, just because you're a journalist, you're not exempted from assassination. What gives you the courage to keep taking him on?
I don't really look at it as taking him on. You know, I do a job. My job is to hold power to account. Rappler, we do stories that the president, that lots of people don't like our stories. President Aquino didn't like our stories. But that is the task of what a reporter does, right? So his rhetoric is noise for me. And while it does send a signal to the government bureaucracy, certainly the cases were triggered by President Duterte, it shouldn't stop us. And certainly we shouldn't allow harassment, intimidation, and the fear of that stop you from doing your job. So as far as I'm concerned, we keep going until the Constitution is changed, if that's the case, right? We demand the rights that are guaranteed not just by the Philippine Constitution, but by the Bill of Rights. We have a Constitution similar to the United States.
Rappler is known for exposing the so-called war on drugs, but where thousands of Filipinos have been killed.
Can I correct how much? It's not just thousands. And this is Michelle Bachelet at the UN who used this number. The latest estimate is since July 1, 2016 until early this year, more than 27,000 people killed. That's a UN estimate, right? The Philippine police will admit they've killed more than 5,000 people. Even that number is huge. But there's another bucket that they go off. It's more than 30,000 homicide cases under investigation. This parsing of the details allows lies to continue.
And explain who is being killed. I mean, President Duterte himself has boasted about murdering people.
He has. And before he even became president, in an interview with me, John Oliver wound up running this. He admitted he killed people, that he killed three people, and that he would continue. You know, another phrase that was used often is that if I'm elected, the fish in Manila Bay will be fat. Because you'll throw dead bodies in Manila Bay, right? That was the implied statement there. These are not the drug dealers who are being killed. These are the poor people. These are in the poorest of the poor areas. And this is also where you can see in statistical surveys, support in this demographic has waned for President Duterte. The people who cannot defend themselves. The people who are on a list, a random list, that is not backed. There is no trial. There's no proof that the people being killed are even drug dealers. I think this is dangerous. In a country that has no rule of law, that normalizes extrajudicial killings, we have to demand better.
And President Trump, his support of President Duterte, how does that affect policy in the Philippines? How does it affect you?
Well, when President Trump called CNN and the New York Times fake news, a week later, President Duterte called Rappler fake news. I think it is a bad time for the world when the former beacon of democracy, the fighter for press freedom and human rights, is noticeably absent. And I think you're feeling that all around the world. Simultaneous to that, though, is the American technology companies that have allowed cheap armies on social media to roll back democracy, a new weapon used against journalists. This is psychological warfare, right?
And when you're holding attacked, up your phones.
Yeah, when you're attacked. At one point, I was getting 90 hate messages per hour. Per hour. You can't even, it's a whole new thing. So anyway, how do we deal with it? We continue doing our jobs. We demand accountability. We tell our people. And I think the problem, though, is that I think maybe it, same in the United States, is in the Philippines, fear is palpable. And if it's not fear, it's apathy. People want to duck until this time period is over. And I think...
Well, you clearly aren't. And I want to thank you so much for being here. 5 seconds, a message to the world about the importance of press freedom.
Press freedom is not just for journalists. I think this is a critical time for democracy around the world, both in the Philippines and in the United States. And you must fight for your rights while you still can.
Filipina journalist Maria Ressa, the co-founder of the independent news site Rappler, speaking on Democracy Now! In 2019. Earlier today, she won the Nobel Peace Prize, along with Russian journalist Dmitry Muratov. They were cited for their, quote, courageous fight for freedom of expression in the Philippines and Russia. To see all our interviews with Maria Ressa, visit democracynow.org. When we come back, the family of Henrietta Lacks is suing the pharmaceutical company Thermo Fisher Scientific for profiting from Henrietta Lacks cells that were taken without her consent in 1951 and have been used for decades by scientists. We'll speak to civil rights attorney Ben Crump and Henrietta Lacks' grandson. Stay with us. Pagang Umaga means new morning by Bayang Barrios. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The family of Henrietta Lacks, the African-American cancer patient whose cells were taken by Johns Hopkins University Hospital without her consent in 1951, is suing the pharmaceutical company Thermo Fisher Scientific and demanding reparations in the intellectual property of those cells. Henrietta Lacks was a young black mother in segregated Baltimore who suffered from metastatic cervical cancer. Doctors took tissue samples from her womb unknowingly that went on to become one of the most productive cell lines, leading to groundbreaking research that became a cornerstone of modern medicine, from cancer care and HIV/AIDS treatment to helping scientists produce remedies for several diseases, including the first polio vaccine and even COVID-19 vaccines. Her cells were just known as HeLa cells. H-E-L-A, the first two letters of Henrietta Lacks' first and last name. But even her family had no clue about her legacy until more than 20 years after her death. The new lawsuit denounces a racist medical system and accuses Thermo Fisher of using the HeLa cell line without their consent while making billions of dollars in profit. The family announced the lawsuit on Monday, 70 years to the day after Henrietta Lacks' death. This is her granddaughter, Kimberly Lacks.
I think about my grandmother, as I said before, laying in that hospital room and how they came in there when she had radiation going through her body in horrific pain, but all they were concerned about was taking cell tissues from her body. Mm. That's terrible.
Terrible.
And then on top of that, no one in the family had any idea. They act like she was alone. They didn't reach out to her husband, her aunt, her cousins, anyone to let them know what was taking place. That's disgraceful. And that definitely is racism, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. She was treated horribly. My father, one thing I can say about him is he's a sweet man. And he always said that, who wouldn't want a pocket full of money? Everybody wants money, but it's a bigger picture. But he did say to me, and he's sickly, but he was very happy and excited to know that we're finally going to get justice, for Henrietta Lacks, for his mother.
For more, we go to Baltimore to speak to Ron Lacks, one of the grandsons of Henrietta Lacks, author of Henrietta Lacks, The Untold Story. We are also joined by one of the family's attorneys, the leading civil rights lawyer, Ben Crump. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Ben, let's start with you. Talk about why you're suing this particular pharmaceutical company and more about what happened to Henrietta Lacks.
Certainly, Amy. Thank you for having Ron and I to talk about this landmark lawsuit that is based on the principle of not just simple justice, not just social justice, but this lawsuit is based largely in part on this notion of genetic justice, the belief that justice should flow from one generation to the next. We have sued the Thermo Fisher Scientific, and there will be others who have derived benefit from the immortal cells of Henrietta Lacks till this day. And we believe unjust enrichment is the legal theory that is well established that allows the estate of Henrietta Lacks to make this claim that taking her cells was wrong. And the law says if you are unjustly enriched from the wrongdoing, then you should not be allowed to continue to benefit at the peril of the victim, which is Henrietta Lacks. And that's why her family, her lineal descendants, are saying, why is it that Henry Ford's family can define his legacy and benefit from his legacy and pass it on to generations of his legacy and unborn children who have yet to come into the world, but their grandmother, this black woman, her great contributions to medicine, her story has been told by everybody else. They're saying we get the right to define her legacy. Everybody else is benefiting. Pharmaceutical companies are making billions upon billions of dollars from Henrietta Lacks' miraculous. Even.
Ben Crump, let me ask you, you're freezing a little bit on Skype. But the company, Thermo Fisher, why just one company then?
Well, and we believe there'd be others. There were many corporations in the aftermath of George Floyd who made a commitment to social justice because they watched George Floyd suffer for 9 minutes and 29 seconds. I submit that what Henrietta Lacks went through was equal, if not far worse, than what George Floyd suffered. So for all those pharmaceutical companies who have made billions, who made the commitment to social justice in the aftermath of George Floyd, where you can prove that commitment by doing right by Henrietta Lacks, finally, do right by her, say her name, because her life matter and Black lives matter. You acknowledge that she was, you know, miraculous. Her cells are the cornerstone of modern medicine, with having medical vaccines created from her cells are developed with polio, with, you know, cancer research. They did in vitro advancements, COVID-19 vaccinations.
What were so special about Henrietta Lacks' cells?
Well, you know, that's a great question. Everybody should know the name of Henrietta Lacks. I mean, not just people in America, but all over the globe, because her cells, for the first time in the history of the world, survived outside of her body. They did this medical experiment in Johns Hopkins, which was tantamount to medical racism, because they used her as a lab rat, as they used many other Black people in that era. But they took the cells. They were trying to see if a cell could survive outside of the body. And nobody to that point could. But Henrietta Lacks' miraculous cells not only survived, but they regenerated every 24 hours and kept regenerating every time they were they cell would continue to regenerate from another cell. And so this was a medical marvel for scientists to be able to use research of actual cells. And so her cells have saved millions and millions of lives. And so that's why, as her son, grandson Ron Lack says, his grandmother is up in heaven and she's looking down and saying, how tremendous it is that my cells are doing all these good things. And she sees all these companies making all this money, I mean, billions of dollars. And she says, well, what about my children? What about my family? And that's why we're bringing this landmark case, not only based in these principles of civil rights, but also in the theory of unjust enrichment, because equity would demand, justice would demand, that Henrietta Lacks' estate is allowed to benefit from the use of her cells. Thermo Fisher does not have intellectual right, property rights over her cells superior than her flesh and blood.
We're going to go to Ron in 1 second. But Ben Crump, I watched your news conference carefully on Monday. That was 70 years to the day that Henrietta Lacks died. And you made a reference to her suffering at the end of her life. Yes, she was a cervical cancer patient. But you talked about radioactive rods being put inside her. Can you explain that weren't actually, this procedure wasn't done to help her?
Absolutely. They were not trying to help her with her cancer. They were experimenting with her, using her as a lab rat, as was the time in the 1950s with Black people. We must remember this was the era when they did the Tuskegee experiment. They did the Alabama appendectomy, where people like Fannie Lou Hamer, Black women, went to hospitals and were lied to They said they were treating them, and they actually sterilized them where they could have no children. And you had black soldiers during this time in World War II being put in gas chambers with faulty gas masks so they could study the effects of the gas chambers on the human body. And when those black soldiers complained, Amy, they were court-martialed and put in prison.
And as a result of the medical experimentation on the African-American community like Tuskegee, you have the situation where African-Americans today are concerned about the COVID-19 vaccine, asking, is their experimentation being done right here? But I want to go right now to Ron Lax, the grandson of Henrietta Lax, and the author of Henrietta Lax, The Untold Story. Ron, thanks so much for joining us. Your grandmother has led to so many medical breakthroughs because of her line, her cell line, the HeLa cells. I was just talking to a science student who said he was told it was based on a Helen Lane. And of course, it's the first two letters of both of her names, Henrietta Lax. When did you learn how that cell line was being used, and talk about the significance of this lawsuit?
Through my mother, Barbette Lax, she uncovered it when she was having lunch with a neighbor, and she was introduced as Barbette Lax. And the professor said, we're working with someone's cells named Henrietta Lax. And my mother told him, that's my mother-in-law. And that's when we first found out, in 1973.
So talk about growing up as the grandson of Henrietta Lax and what you understood and how you actually learned about what happened with your grandmother and what caused you to write your book, Henrietta Lax, The Untold Story.
Well, when they started doing interviews with my family, that's when more information about what was going on at the time. So I was young. I was a teenager. So I didn't understand it too much until later years when I found out all what her cells has been doing. And my father, I watched him try to get lawyers with no success. So he was by parents was trying to find out what was going on with her cells and who was doing what. And we found out that pharmaceuticals was enriching their cells. So my father, like I said, unsuccessfully tried. And coming up, it took a strain on him because he watched his mother, when he was a teenager, the radiation bars that was inserted in her. Took his toll on his mother, and he watched that, and he's disturbed from that right to this day. So when this hit the media, they took a different approach to the family, where my father was trying to explain what was going on with him trying to get control of Henrietta's legacy. They turned their back on him, even at a meeting with NIH and John Hopkins, and my dad was there with his attorney, and they had Rebecca Skloot on the line, mainly listened to what she had to say instead of my dad and his attorney. So I seen the total disrespect to my father, and I had to get what he experienced from his mother to what we was going through, and the world should know what was done to this family. They try to divide us. They tried to keep us in the dark about things. And I had to tell a story. It's a very interesting story, what we went through. And I think no family should ever go through this.
And then talk about your attempts to bring lawsuits to challenge, reshape the narrative of your grandmother, and then going on your book tour, one place, and making the final connection in this latest lawsuit.
Well, like I said, they tried for years to get attorneys to take this case up. This is John Hopkins' backyard. So we wasn't getting nowhere. Only allies that we had was University of Maryland and Donnie Glover. You know, the only ones that would respect the Lax family. So when I went to Texas on my first booking sign-in, and they embraced me, and I talked to the congregation there, and I met a young man, and he introduced me to Ben Crum. And that's when the light got shined on this situation, and I'm so happy. So God is good.
Can you talk about how your family was defamed, the stories told about your family that were untrue to discredit you, to try not to seek some kind of reparations for what happened to your grandmother?
Well, okay, for one thing, Rebecca Skloot has embarrassed Henrietta's children, all four of them. She called my dad, Sonny, and Abdul greedy. Because they're only in this for the money. But my father and them was in this ever since 1973, just trying to get the rights to his grandmother's legacy. So, and Henrietta Lacks.
Rebecca Skloot, of course, is the author of another book on Henrietta Lacks that has been a multi-year bestseller, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. Go ahead, Ron.
Exactly. And she had in there that my grandmother signed her name with an X. That's why I put in the back of my book with a poem, my grandmother's John Hancock, right in the back. She had beautiful penmanship. So, and illiterate. Try to say that my grandmother was illiterate. She wasn't. She was a beautiful, black, intelligent woman that loved her family and loved her neighbors. So my grandmother would feed the neighborhood. And now you're asking her not to feed her children? That don't sound right to me. She was a wonderful woman.
What does it mean as you move forward, your family standing together at this lawsuit, the grandchildren speaking up for your parents, the children of Henrietta Lacks?
Well, next generation. That's what I'm saying, that the Lacks family needs to take back control of Henrietta's legacy so we can pass down to the next generation of Laxes, so they won't have to go through this fight that my grandfather and my dad went through. So that's why I had to speak out and tell my story.
Ron Lacks, I want to thank you for being with us, grandson of Henrietta Lacks, author of Henrietta Lacks, The Untold Story, speaking to us from Baltimore, and Ben Crump, civil rights attorney, speaking to us from Houston. Coming up, we speak to historian Keisha Blaine, author of the new book, Until I'm Free, Fannie Lou Hamer's Enduring Message to America. All that and more coming up. Singing with other civil rights activists, This Little Light of Mine. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we end today's show, looking at the fight over voting, a new report by the Brennan Center has found 19 states have enacted 33 laws to make it harder for people to vote. Earlier this week, People for the American Way President Ben Jealous and four others were arrested outside the White House. They were calling on the Senate to remove the filibuster as an obstacle in passing voting rights. We turn now to look at a pioneering woman in the struggle to guarantee voting rights, Fannie Lou Hamer. She's the subject of a new book by the acclaimed historian Keisha Blaine. Fannie Lou Hamer was the daughter of Mississippi sharecroppers who became involved in the civil rights movement when she volunteered to attempt to register to vote in 1962. By then, the 45-year-old mother lost her job and continuously risked her life over her civil rights activism, despite this and a brutal beating. Fannie Lou Hamer helped organize the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party to challenge the white domination of the Mississippi Democratic Party. In 1964, the party challenged the all-white Mississippi delegation at the Democratic National Convention with Fannie Lou Hamer as the leader. Her voice, along with others, led to an integrated Mississippi delegation in 1968. This is part of her address at the Democratic National Convention in Atlantic City, New Jersey, on August 22, 1964, where she testified before the Credentials Committee about her efforts to register to vote.
It was the 31st of August in 1962 that 18 of us traveled 26 miles to the county courthouse in Indianola to try to register to become first-class citizens. We was met in Indianola by policemen, highway patrolmen, and they only allowed two of us in to take the literacy test at the time. After we had taken this test and started back to Roosevelt, we was held up by the city police and the state highway patrolmen and carried back to Indianola, where the bus driver was charged that day with driving a bus the wrong color. After we paid the fine among us, we continued on to Roosevelt, and Reverend Jeff Sonny carried me 4 miles in the rural area where I had worked as a timekeeper and sharecropper for 18 years. I was met there by my children. They told me the plantation owner was angry because I had gone down, tried to register. After they told me, my husband came and said the plantation owner was raising Cain because I had tried to register. And before he quit talking, the plantation owner came and said, Fannie Lou, do you know, did Pap tell you what I said? And I said, yes, sir. He said, well, I mean that, said, if you don't go down and withdraw your registration, you will have to leave. Said, then if you go down and withdraw, said, you still might have to go because we are not ready for that in Mississippi. And I addressed him and told him, said, I didn't try to register for you. I tried to register for myself. I had to leave that same night. On the 10th of September, 1962, 16 bullets were fired into the home of Mr. and Mrs. Robert Tucker for me. That same night, two girls were shot in Roosevelt, Mississippi. Also, Mr. Joe McDonald's house was shot in. If the Freedom Democratic Party is not seated now, I question America. Is this America, the land of the free and the home of the brave, where we have to sleep with our telephones off of the hook because our lives be threatened daily because we want to live as decent human beings in America?
That was Fannie Lou Hamer's address at the Democratic National Convention, Atlantic City, in 64. For more, we're joined by Keisha Blaine, award-winning historian and author of the new book, Until I Am Free, Fannie Lou Hamer's Enduring Message to America. Professor Blaine, welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Talk about that moment in time and why you have decided to write a book on Fannie Lou Hamer.
Well, this particular moment, I think, is the most well-known moment in Hamer's life. I think anyone who knows anything about Fannie Lou Hamer know her in the context of the 1964 Democratic National Convention. And as everyone has already heard, she spoke so passionately about Black voting rights, shared her painful experiences organizing in Mississippi, And I think for me, certainly over the last couple of months, and I would say over the last couple of years, I've been thinking deeply about Fannie Lou Hamer, certainly her fight for voting rights, but more so thinking about her political strategies, thinking about her ideas and how they might be applicable to addressing a number of social problems, which, of course, we are still dealing with, including voter suppression. So I wanted to write a book that would help connect the dots and be a useful educational tool for many.
So talk about the trajectory of Fannie Lou Hamer's life.
Well, one of the things that I explain in the book is that she came to the civil rights movement fairly late in life. She joined the movement in August 1962 at the age of 44. But one of the things that I think also is important in thinking about how her activism developed is a painful experience that she endured a year before she joined the civil rights movement. And that is in 1961. She was the victim of a forced sterilization. And of course, that is fitting in light of our conversation already about Henrietta Lacks. And Fannie Lou Hamer went through this painful experience in 61, which initially she did not talk about publicly. But when she became a civil rights activist in 62, one of the things that she did was she spoke out about state-sanctioned violence, not only talking about police brutality, police violence, but also talking about medical violence, talking about how white physicians in Mississippi, across the South, would perform this terrible practice of forced sterilizations. And so Hamer became a voice not only for civil rights, but also, I think, broadly for human rights.
She spoke out painfully about her own experiences. In this recording, Fannie Lou Hamer recounts her beating at the hands of two other black prisoners on the orders of her white jailers in Mississippi after she traveled to a distant courthouse to take the state's required literacy test to vote. The recording is from the Pacifica Radio Archive, which has one of the largest archives of Fannie Lou Hamer recordings.
And three white men came to my cell, and one of them was a state highway patrolman because he was wearing a little silver plate across his pocket that said John L. Bassinger. And he asked me where I was from, and I told him I was from Louisville. And he said, I'm going to check that. And he went out, and I guess he called Louisville. And they didn't like me in Louisville because I worked with voter registration there. And when he came back, he said, you damn right. They said, you're from Louisville, all right. And we going to make you wish you was dead. And they led me out of that cell into another cell. And he gave a Negro prisoner a blackjack, and he ordered me to lay down on a bunk bed. And a Negro prisoner said, do you want me to beat her with this, sir? And he said, you're damn right, because if you don't, you know what I'll do for you. And I laid down on the bunk like he ordered me to do. And the first Negro beat me. He beat me until he was exhausted. And after he beat the state highway patrolman, ordered the second Negro to take the blackjack. And during the time he was beating, I began to work my feet because that was a horrible experience. And the state highway patrolman ordered the first Negro that had beat to sit on my feet while the second one beat. And I just began to scream where I couldn't control it. And then the white man got up and began to beat me in my head. I have a blood clot now in the artery to the left eye, and a permanent kidney injury on the right side from that beating. These are the things that we go through in the state of Mississippi, just trying to be treated like a human being.
Just trying to be treated like a human being. Those are the words of Fannie Lou Hamer, preserved by the Pacifica Radio Archive. It is utterly painful decades later to hear this description, but also the vibrancy of Fannie Lou Hamer. What is most misunderstood about her, Professor Blaine?
Well, I think so many people who know about Fannie Lou Hamer will know her in the context of the American Civil Rights Movement. Of course, we're talking about the key role she played in expanding Black political rights. But I think in the process of writing the book, one of the things that really stayed with me is how much we have to think about Hamer and talk about her as a human rights activist. And this is something that she said. She said that, yes, she was certainly fighting for civil rights, but she was fighting for human rights broadly. And Hamer connected the struggle of Black people in the United States with the struggle for liberation across the globe. And this was something that I think, you know, I certainly hope in reading the book that people will come to appreciate, to think about her internationalist perspective. That I think is so vital in understanding her legacy.
Black women have been so central to so many human rights struggles around the world, anti-colonial, black freedom, human rights, but aren't seen as being that central. Talk about the centrality of black women like Fannie Lou Hamer when it comes to pushing for democracy here and around the world.
Black women have been vital to the struggle for human rights for decades, for centuries. And as you point out, I think so many times when we tell these narratives, mainstream narratives, tend to focus on the political, work of men. So we still have these male-dominated narratives. We also have these masculinist narratives, ones that do not pay attention to the way that black women not only led but really strategize. They were activists as well as thinkers. They were producers of knowledge. And I think Fannie Lou Hamer's story is an important reminder of the centrality of Black women in shaping political movements, even when they are marginalized, in the broader narratives. Their work certainly remain vital. And to this very day, we're talking about Hamer. She has left a remarkable legacy.
And talk about your choice of the title, Until I Am Free.
Until I Am Free comes from a phrase that Hamer said repeatedly as she traveled across the United States in the late 60s and also the 70s. She would say that whether you are black or white, you are not free until I am free. And this is a message that I think we have to remember today. All of us, despite our differences, regardless of our racial background, regardless of our ethnicity, regardless of our sexuality, our socioeconomic status, we are all members of this American polity. And I think Hamer's phrase was an important reminder that because we are all connected, we have to work together to ensure that we build, this nation to become an inclusive democracy that we certainly said it should be according to the values stated in the Constitution.
I want to thank you so much for being with us, Keisha Blaine, author of Until I Am Free, Fannie Lou Hamer's Enduring Message to America. Professor Blaine teaches history at the University of Pittsburgh. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for two full-time positions, a director of finance and administration and a human resources manager. You can learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Felsmeyer-Burke, Dina Guzder-Messiah-Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Marie Terracena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alcock, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, and Adriano Contreras. Our general manager is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Marion Barnard, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Dennis Moynihan, Hugh Graham. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
And your soul is next.
We don't actually have the legal documentation to back that up.
up with the black gang. Up with the black.